So my name is Ryan Nilsson. I'm currently a student at Duke Divinity School, completing a summer internship with the National Farm Worker Ministry. This interview will primarily be for a National Farm Worker Ministry organizational documentary project. And with your consent, both the audio and the transcribed text of our conversation today may be used for National Farm Worker Ministry publications and projects. I also hope to use the text of this interview as part of my research project on the National Farm Worker Ministry that I'm completing as my thesis for a Master of Theological Studies degree at Duke. I also intend to preserve this and other interviews for future research and archives. Do you, Dave Austin, give your consent to using this interview for these purposes?
I do.
Great. So, once again, this is Ryan Nilsson, and I'm interviewing Dave Austin here at the National Farm Worker Ministry Office, housed in the Eno River Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Durham, North Carolina. It's about 3:30 p.m. in the afternoon on Monday, July 25th, 2011. So let's get started.
Okay.
How did you first get involved with the National Farm Worker Ministry, Dave?
Well, I'm going to jump back a bit because when I came to North Carolina and went to the School of Public Health, my first job when I got out of the School of Public Health in 1976 was with something called the Carolina Brown Lung Association. So I had that beginning work with a labor organization, I guess you would call them. They were mostly a group of retired or disabled and retired textile workers who'd been disabled by brown lung, which is caused by cotton dust in the mill. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I had that experience and subsequent experience with for 5 years, and then 5 years with the North Carolina Occupational Safety and Health Project, which focused more broadly on occupational health issues in North Carolina, occupational safety and health, but mostly health, and was a coalition of health professionals, legal professionals, and workers, mostly labor unions. So with that experience, and after that I wasn't formally involved with labor issues, but continued to be an interest of mine. In any case, I had been at ERF for, must have been about 8 or 9 years, I guess, when I started going to ERF. It was about 1990, I think, maybe a little before. But in 1998, and at first, unbeknownst to me, there was a group here that became aware of FLOC's effort, Farm Labor Organizing Committee's effort in the Midwest, which I'd read about, but it was in the Midwest. Wasn't completely relevant to me here. Anyway, they'd read about that and the fact that FLOC had decided they needed to come to North Carolina. So this was Sandy Smith Nonini and John Olson were sort of leaders at that time in starting to try to convince the congregation to take up this issue. And when I heard about it, it made a lot of sense. And so I joined the effort. So that was 1999 sometime. And I had been involved a little with what was called, I guess, I don't know if they're still around, the Triangle Friends of Farm Workers here in the 1990s, which was led by Joanne Price and was more connected with the United Farm Worker effort and lending support to it. So that's how I got started.
Cool. So it seemed like the community here at ERF started getting involved with something that you already had some experience with labor organizations. How has your faith perspective, being a part of this Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, affected your involvement with the ministry? Or has it?
I think the biggest way it influenced me was trying to figure out how people in Erif saw their faith and how they might, or how we might persuade them that it should or could lead them to support for labor causes. I mean, there was a few, as I said, a few sort of a nucleus here that had a, for whatever reason, for whatever individual reasons, had some sympathy with labor issues, but the vast majority didn't. I mean, it wasn't a natural thing for them. So I think in terms of faith, it probably helped me start examining what you use, what their principles are, because I needed to see what people thought, how they were reacting to social justice issues, or how they should react to social justice issues. I think personally, I probably didn't have a real strong faith impetus that drove me to it. It was more, at least a religious faith. I mean, there was, it feels like a faith. It's just something I believed ever since graduate school, since I started working with Brownline, got involved in that issue. It just seems justice issues are a part of the world that we have, that we should be thinking more clearly about and doing something about. So, but not steeped in a theology for me particularly, no.
Yeah. How has the effort to get the broader Erif community involved gone over the years?
That's interesting. Right at first, there was we had a bigger group that was involved. I think, you know, it was new, I guess, and there were people that wondered what it was going to be about, and then fairly soon we started leafleting at grocery stores. That was the way we could lend our support to National Farm Worker Ministry and Flock efforts at that time, because the Mount Olive pickle boycott had started. And not many people, even some of our biggest supporters, felt, I think, that this was sort of, in a way, a futile effort almost, you know. I mean, to be honest, some days you'd go out there and it did seem fairly futile. I mean, it was just a drop in the bucket of public opinion. If you persuaded one or two people not to buy Mount Olive pickles, so what? But anyway, but I think through the years there was always effort to figure out, to try and think about the needs of the congregation. And a lot of times it seemed like people were just, I think naturally, or like most congregations, were more interested, sympathetic with actions that were service oriented, you know, that were and in fact, people brought up the idea of somehow establishing schools for people to learn English better, for supplying people with stuff they would need out in the fields, you know, better or shirts, hats, protective equipment, maybe if that was needed. For, you know, there was a couple times during those years when there was hurricanes, and not only were just your average North Carolina residents devastated, but you can imagine how farm workers had been devastated. And so there was some talk, no action, about, well, what can we do for people who are at camps, you know, and have been turned upside down? What other kinds of service stuff did people think about? In any case, that is the orientation and was the orientation of a lot of people. How can we help? How can we provide things these people don't have? And we couldn't. It was hard to get to the point of they actually hearing and hearing that workers were saying, that's not particularly what we need. We can do something. We can do something on our own, and we're doing it. If you can help some, that's great. But I think we got there. I think we did get there with a few people. You know, I mean, we had some great staff here at the National Farm Worker Ministry, and when people would go out to camps or when we do almost anything, people would start to understand what it was all about. But you know, one or two at a time.
So, can you tell me a story of a specific situation in this work with Flock and Eruf that has had a significant kind of lasting impact on you today?
Well, I guess it's not one specific, but every time I went to a Flock meeting, I was just so impressed that here you'd see guys, farm workers, on Sunday afternoon when they had, you know, that was their day of rest, and here they had driven 2 hours or something like that to come to this meeting, and then they'd be so animated in their discussions about you know, what they were going to have as contract issues over the next year, or why the last year's contract issues hadn't been fulfilled and what they could do about it. And you know, half the time I didn't know what was going on, because my Spanish is pretty minimal. But it was just so interesting and so enlivening to see them there deliberating and arguing, and also the Flock leaders themselves. I mean, all the staff they've had have been incredible people, and it was just inspirational to me. And then when we got to I think there was a national or a statewide convention they had in Raleigh, so we had people from, you know, the whole state, and that was even better, because you had it was just a larger group, and you had people from identified by their Mexican state sitting out in this auditorium, you know, and it was just so cool.
How do you think that's impacted you? So it was inspiring, inspirational.
Well, I think I hope I've been able to argue for people participating in this cause better since seeing that, because I think that's really the crux of what we're doing here. If we're going to be an ally, I mean, we should be an ally if this is an issue we want to look at. But being an ally means that if there's an organization of workers, we don't need to go off and identify how we can help them. They can tell us what we can do, you know, and they're perfectly capable, as was evident in these meetings, of figuring out stuff on their own. And it's not that they don't need help and money and whatever, but they're just as strong and as intelligent and hardworking and everything else as any group that wants to achieve something. So if we want to be allies, that we can find out where we can fit in. And so being at those meetings, I think, just reinforced that feeling in me. And I hope that I was able to argue that, maybe a little bit.
Yeah. So you're saying that you're able to argue that to the, the people to get involved. How would you do that to people? What would you say to people who are interested in or maybe not interested, what would you say to people in order to get them involved at this point?
Well, I guess I would try and actually what we mostly did was try and get people involved first through service kinds of stuff, because that was just so much a natural feeling. But service whose ultimate objective was to help, was to fit in with National Farm Worker Ministry FLOC activities. So like driving a car or fixing a lunch for workers that were meeting here for a FLOC meeting was a pretty good compromise. I mean, it was a easier way to for people to understand, you know, well, ERF is hosting a meeting, so how can we do that? People had a feeling, well, if we're hosting, of course I could help do something. I mean, people at a church feel that, yeah, we should be good hosts, you know, we have guests. And so that was one way, probably the main way that we tried to set things up and probably not make the philosophical argument too much, just set it up for people to participate and then come and hear a little bit or see a little bit. And sometimes Alex or whoever was in the National Farm Worker Ministry role would call volunteers together, say after or even during a flock meeting, and say, okay, let's talk about what's happening. And so some of that understanding and motivation we left to this organization, which was probably a good idea.
Yeah. I don't know.
Well, Alex and Lori before her were really good. They're both so good at thinking through that on their feet, you know, when they're talking to people.
Mm-hmm. So in that time, starting people out with these more concrete service-based issues, but ultimately wanting to get them involved with supporting this justice work and flock.
Well, yeah, I mean, the work itself might not change, but you would like people to understand that supporting the worker organization was in that way, and perhaps other ways. I mean, we did have a few people that, for example, after you know, participating in some of those service focused activities, then went to say RJR's annual meeting, you know, and stood outside and picketed. So it was trying to open them up to that broader range of kinds of advocacy, I guess. Advocacy based on what the organization said they needed, but advocacy nonetheless. And, you know, I think it worked with a few people. And it's hard to know what people think. I mean, how many people, you know, if two people went to the RJR thing, but maybe more were persuaded, I don't know. You know, they just couldn't go that day. Well, that happens a lot.
And you think, you said it's hard to know what people think. Do you think that there's some general trends, or do you have ideas about what type of people, or what it is that would help someone make that transition in thinking? Or it's just kind of you put it out there and people.
Yeah, I think we just put it out there, and I probably didn't, or our committee probably didn't do enough of trying to engage in that conversation of you know, what is the what's the motivation for any of our work in social justice? I mean, we did put a whole, when was that, October of 2009, we put together and worked on it a lot of the year, a workshop that was focused on how do we decide what's important enough to do, and what's the difference between these sort of service-focused work and advocacy work, and what does it mean to you? And it was a good workshop. I, you know, it was hard to tell how much, how, if people felt changed by that or not. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about UU principles, what are the sorts of things that end up getting brought into the conversation?
Well, like the inherent worth and dignity of every person. I mean, that's sort of a bedrock, and I think it does come up in these conversations, and has in our conversations that we're having on immigration, obviously. But jumping from there, I think jumping from there to a worker organization and how or if we should work with them is a big jump for people. Something of I think there's something, especially in the South, I guess, where it's suspect. You know, there's worker organizations, unions, the word union is suspect. And I think it sometimes people can't get past that.
Yeah, bringing in the South and kind of the culture here as it affects this work is something I've thought about a lot. Where are you from originally?
Missouri.
That's right.
North Missouri. Almost in Iowa.
And you're already, I mean, you're identifying that there's a distinct kind of way in which there's a stigma, I guess, around unions, or you said like the word union. Are there specific instances when that has come into play, this kind of cultural resistance to workers' organizations?
Well, here at church, I mean, I think when the issue was first voted on, and I wasn't even there when the congregation voted to take this on as an issue, and at the same time to support the Malawi boycott, I heard that there was some fairly explicit objections that, you know, we shouldn't get involved with union labor management issues. It was pretty a small minority, evidently, from the vote, but I don't know how many other people that sort of resonated with, you know. My impression is that it probably does resonate with some proportion of people, but it's not something they would talk about very easily, you know. So, and I've never lived in New York or some place where unions are widely accepted, but I've talked with enough people that I think there's just a different ethos about it, that there's just a suspicion down here, and it's been here for a long time. And even people that are progressive, that's not one issue that they're particularly progressive on, you know.
Being raised in northern Missouri, that wasn't something you had to overcome yourself. You weren't raised with that kind of suspicion.
Small town Missouri. I mean, I probably didn't know what a union was through growing up in high school. I probably read about it in a social studies book once or twice, but that was the extent. If there was a union in Chillicothe of anything, I didn't know it. And the same in small town Iowa, where I went to college too. It didn't become an issue for me until graduate school.
Yeah, that's interesting, because it wasn't until you came to the South, I guess, that the kind of no union zone, that became an issue of real interest and involvement.
Yeah. But it was probably graduate school that got me, and not graduate school in Iowa, where I studied neurophysiology of invertebrates, but School of Public Health, where we had some good classes on sort of political economy, and that was the first time I got aware of these issues. So,
kind of trying to ask this question several different ways, but a big part of why we're doing this and having these conversations is to try to understand and be able to make the case to people for why they should get involved. So just kind of, I'm curious to just directly ask you, why should people get involved with the National Farm Worker Ministry?
Well, for me, because the National Farm Worker Ministry is involved in support of worker organizing, I think there can be concrete results. And that is unlike a lot of issues you can become involved in. Workers are empowered, you know. Although our faith that would happen was shaky sometimes. Boy, on that day in 2004 when the Mount Olive Pickle boycott was won, that helped. So I think that's my argument, we should become involved because it can make a difference. That difference will go beyond just this union of farm workers, that the Hispanic community in general, as some of these guys stay around to do other jobs, and as the Hispanic community in North Carolina also lends some support, it will become a political force. And I've always thought that that in itself may help break down the black-white dichotomy that we run up against so much. So that's one reason I think that it's important. I mean, plus it's right there in our backyard. It's like invisible, but nonetheless, 150,000 people out there who, you know, I mean, I don't know. We think a lot about work in third world countries and how oppressed people are, but it's right out there.
Have there been any times in your work with Flock and the ministry where you've personally experienced some strong opposition? I don't know if in personal relationships or family or any sort of situation where that really became a controversial issue in your life.
Just trying to think. I don't. My first reaction is I don't think so. I mean,
fortunate.
I had, you know, any family reactions around this issue were clear back in the when I worked with the Brown Lung Association, and that was, I mean, that was even. At least in my estimation, was even more clear cut. I mean, here were people disabled and, you know, barely able to walk sometimes, and it was pretty clear. It was becoming medically pretty clear that the fault was at the workplace, and that but that fault had been obscured on purpose for years. So it was. I mean, it was. So at least in terms of family, my dad is a. I would have to say an arch conservative. He's got Fox News on all the time, but so for the most part we just don't talk politics. But we did talk. I mean, I talked about my work back then, and there was never much pushback, I think, because at least my presentation of it was you know, why isn't this a good thing to do? I mean, I think there has been some. There has been some a little pushback in ERIF because and even now still is. I mean, there's a thought Well, the way the church organizes its and selects its activities that it'll focus on and put some priorities on, it's always been an issue of concern for people. And
I think our power's back on.
Oh yeah, I guess that's it.
I'll turn the lights on then.
Okay.
Just for the record, the power had gone off at Eruf because we had a storm here, but it's back on. All right, sorry.
So, when people have seen the farm worker support action team here at Eruf be fairly small, that I think there's been a question, well, should we really be doing this, because it's not involving many people, and one of the objectives of our social justice work should be to get lots of people involved. And so that's been right from, I mean, just continuing right from the start, and it's clear up till now. I mean, there's still a justifiably, I guess, yeah, we want to get lots of people involved. I would love to get lots of people involved. And we give the opportunity to people, but it's true that there have not ever been a lot of people, compared to the size of this church, involved in farm worker support activities. So I guess my response has been to make it seem as much as possible through documenting what we do like a good activity, and sort of not talking about how few people were actually involved. Good PR can go a long way. But I think, I mean, you know, it's going to only go so far, and there's always going to be that push. It seemed at times that we had, the social justice types of activities and leaders were pretty fluid, you know. We could say, I want to work on that, and I've got a couple people, and we'll do it. And they said, oh yeah, go ahead. But then there'll be another cycle where they come back and say, well, you know, shouldn't we try and establish three or two activities that lots of people want to work on, and we'll all just focus on those. So that's been, that has from time to time been an issue. They've never actually gotten down to the point of sort of enforcing that. We have gone through prioritization activities, and you know, there'd be three activities come out on top, and they wouldn't be farm workers. But it was never said, well, then you should stop working on farm workers and work on these other things. Although I have, and maybe other people in the farm worker support group have too, said, okay, I can put some energy into this number one priority, but I'm still going to continue doing farm workers, almost as a sort of a safety valve kind of thing, you know.
Mm-hmm. At times when you're telling your story, you've presented a relatively seamless transition from the Brown Lung kind of graduate school involvement and then, you know, into this flock work with Eruf. Or have there been substantial differences in your experiences between those, like working with labor organizations?
Well, Brown Lung was with a organization that had more resources and more staff. So we had chapters, Brown Lung Association chapters that were organizing in probably from 12 to 15 North and South Carolina and Georgia, actually, communities for a while. And so when we'd get together, or even just around here, I had other people to relate to as staff. So it was different in that way. NCOSH, the COSH group that I was sort of more formally affiliated with after that, was a smaller organization, but we often had two or three staff, paid staff. So and we were interacting with, not fairly often, with union organizations that were our members. So we'd, you know, be setting up a conference with union presidents from around the state. So what was the question? I lost it.
Sorry. I was asking what's been distinct, maybe, or different about working with FLOC?
Well, you know, there was a lot of similarities when I was with Brown Lung, because we were the organization then that was connecting with, at some level, with the Union of Textile Workers, ACTU, which it was named at that time. And they, at some points, were just as mysterious and seemed just as disorganized as FLOC does sometimes here. Probably for the same reasons, that they are stretched so thin, it's just hard to, you know, communicate with our own members sometimes, and much less communicate with groups and individuals outside the organization. But from our vantage point, both now and back then, it was hard. They were hard to work with, because you couldn't quite see the plan, and sometimes it changed, and you didn't know it. Back then, though, there was some. I think the union didn't quite trust us. But here, I've never felt that Baltimore, that FLOC didn't trust the National Farm Worker Ministry or you know, any of its participating churches. They may have wondered why we did some things too, I suppose, I suspect, but I've actually never heard that. I mean, I've never heard FLOC say anything but great things about the support they get, despite the fact that it hasn't been as good as it could have been sometimes. But.
Well, I think, I mean, I've covered a lot of the kind of questions I was interested in asking you directly. Are there other things that you think would be important to share with me, with the National Farm Worker Ministry, anyone else who might end up with these interviews?
Well, I should go on the record as saying another motivation for working with this organization was the opportunity to work with organizational leaders like Lori and like Alex. I mean, it was just so invigorating to work with people that were young, but were such great organizers and were so dedicated to the work. I mean, it was just so much fun. And that I could learn stuff from, you know. I think they both had outlooks that I'd learn from. So there was that. That was another reason for working with this organization. It made it so easy to be right in contact with people that you really respected. And then the other side of that, I guess, is the opportunity to work sporadically or interact sporadically with Baltimore and his staff, but particularly him. Who, I mean, I just think he's incredible. So those are other reasons, I guess.
Well, if you have any other specific kind of stories or memories to share, this would be a great time. Or we can also kind of wrap up earlier than I thought.
What else? The other thing that I felt, we had some good people on the committee too. I guess that was the other reason for participating. You never knew John Olson. He moved away, but he was a He was an IBM executive. And how he got his politics, I still don't understand. I mean, he came from up in the Northeast, so maybe that's helped. But here he is, a corporate person for 30 years, and they basically retired down here, and he, but, and every once in a while he would be cantankerous about some issue, but it was always trying to put his principles into play, so working with him was great, and other people too, like Sandy Smith Nonini, who's still around, who she wasn't really much of any ruffian, but she did champion this issue and helped us get started. But just a wide array of people, you know, it was interesting to see the people that would come out and participate in one way or another.
How do people hear about, like if someone's not involved with ERUF, how do you manage your publicity or kind of community contacts as far as the
probably framework? Not people wouldn't know much about what we're doing here. I mean, we rarely, unless we, I mean, National Farm Worker Ministry would be doing things with other faith communities, and so that's where we would interact with people. And so, you know, we might go back to Raleigh UU and say to the people that we had met, and say, you know, we're doing this other thing on social and economic justice event. Why don't you come over? That kind of thing. But in general, we rarely did something that was publicized into the wider community. You know, to Durham, to the region. People wouldn't know about it.
And you said you've done some sort of stuff with like the Raleigh UU. Have there been any sort of relationships built through this work with non-UU congregations, or just kind of meeting individuals?
Just meeting individuals, I would say, yeah. And not very strong, at least I can say this for me, not very strong even then. I mean, it would be somebody I'd see who drove workers to a meeting, and so I drove too, and then I'd see them during the meeting and start to recognize them, you know, National Farm Worker Ministry sometimes, fairly often, would have a get together of volunteers and give a briefing on, you know, what this meeting was all about, what the union's plan was for the next month or next summer. So we sort of got to know each other a bit that way, but it was very sporadic, you know. We, as a task force here at ERIF, we did some outreach to other UU congregations in the state to say, this is a great issue. If you can't get involved, if you can't, you know, they really need money. So we did some fundraising that way, and then we did... three of us in the committee did some presentations at church services, where we went out and talked very generally about, you know, ethical eating, and moved from there out into the work we were doing with farm workers. But now people. Generally wouldn't know we're here and doing this work in Durham, I don't think, unless the ministers talk about it at interdenominational meetings or something.
DCIA.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, thank you for sitting together. Do you have anything else you want to add before we kind of close it?
Stories. You asked about stories. I'm just trying to think if there was anything. Oh, the reason I thought about John Olson was that for a while during the Mount Olive pickle boycott, some of the Duke students were involved and persuaded Nan Cohane, the president at that time, to essentially support the boycott for a while, and then she had saw the need to bring Bill Bryan, the president of Mount Olive, in to talk with her. And at that meeting, she was persuaded that, I guess, she'd been rash. And so they backtracked on supporting the boycott. But anyway, John and I can't remember, maybe Lori and maybe, I can't remember who, went in and to talk with her after that. And I wasn't there, so, but I remember being proud that they'd taken the initiative, you know, to go to set up that meeting and go say, we don't think you did, you made a mistake. And it didn't change her mind, I don't think, or at least they didn't change back the policy. But it wasn't all that long after that the boycott was won, after the United Methodist Church nationally came down on the side of the boycott. Things started to change pretty quick.
I don't know if I was reading about or talking with somebody about the Duke situation, but I'm pretty sure that the reversal came early summer after the students had...
Oh, yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how that works, but important to keep in mind maybe with student organizing.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Cool. All right, well, yeah, thanks a lot, David.
Oh, sure.
It's been really good.
Sure.
And I appreciate your time. And